The idea here is we're going to start a new course of study. We're going to do a Gemara and Shabbos. We're actually going to start from the beginning. And we're going to, at least today, we'll start with, this is like similar, we had a case at that time, which was like this crazy case that we had fun with, and we then took it through the whole, you know, from step A going all the way to Z, even though we didn't complete the whole circle, but we got a sense of like the enormity of the, or the expansiveness of our Torah in terms of taking it from the beginning points and then working it straight through to even current, you know, decisors, let's say it that way. So what I'd like to do here is I want to go into a specific, let's say in Hebrew, a certain inyan, but the idea of a certain specific subject matter. We're going to start with the Gemara, but actually before the Gemara even, I'm going to take you back a little bit to the Torah, what the Torah says, and then we're going to learn the Gemara. And the way I like to approach Gemara is also to weave in some of the ideas, the thoughts behind, like the themes that are going on here behind the scenes, so to speak, kind of like the deeper, you know, meanings that are going on here. So it's like it's a fuller picture. And part of what we're going to do here together also, it's very important, is that we are living this study. We're not just like taking some kind of archaic thing reading it and learning it, but we're going to actually work together to try to get a better understanding of things. So it's a collective work. That's what Torah is supposed to be. Torah is supposed to be collective working and developing. So my job here is just to get presenting and for you guys to actually get very hands-on involved to give, you know, your ideas and understanding of things. So I'm just here to lay it out. And then together as a group, we're going to work it together, call it a chabura, let's say, which means that we come together and we work it to figure out, to get to the sense of like understanding, like what's really going on here. And then the reason we do it that way is because it's not some kind of static thing. We're trying to get down to like the principles so that once we have those basic working principles, we can then apply it. Because the idea really is to be able to apply things, to figure out what the underpinnings of these laws are, and then to take it to the next step, okay? So with that, what we're going to study is, now, when it came to Shabbos is the idea of the day of rest. Now, rest from creative work. Not work, but creative work. And so the Torah basically gives us 39 malachot, 39 creative actions that we're prohibited from. And then that's kind of like the basis for all these other, we're going to see that there are offshoots from those 39. The weird thing is that in the Gemara, the Talmud, in Shabbos, it starts off, it doesn't give us the 39 until much later in the Masechta, in the tractate, which is very strange. What it starts with is what they call the Tosas calls it, and also the other early commentators, the Rishonim, they call it kind of like a funny, not necessarily, here we're going to say that you're supposed to refrain from creative work. Malacha is the idea of creative work, right? That means I'm going to take something and I'm going to enhance it. I'm going to make it better. What do we start with? A thing that doesn't seem to be anything like that at all, which is the idea of taking something from one domain to another domain. Okay?
So the problem is that on Shabbos, you're supposed to have sex with your wife on Shabbos, but wife make a baby.
So that's not creative work. Well,
it's not?
Well, it's interesting. It's a great...
Where's the loophole on that one, Rabbi?
For the time being, I'm going to think about it and come back to you.
It's not work.
No. So let's just leave it. Hold on. Stop, Doc. Leave it on the side. Don't go there. Okay.
Right.
Nice try. We're not. I'm not even going to play that one. I'm just going to let it off the side. But here's this thing. It's like, if we're saying that there... So what are the 39? The 39 basically are coming as the things that they used to create the and do work in the tabernacle. Okay, so that became like the idea of creative work. So for example, and we'll, the truth is we can get to it another time because I don't want to get too deep into that because I really want to focus on this outlier, which the crazy thing is when you go through the Talmud of Shabbos and to the next tractate, which is called Erevin, it spends a lot of time, on an enormous amount of time on the idea of going from one domain to another and carrying something. So I'm going to move an object from private domain to the public domain. I'm going to take something from the public domain into the private domain, and the Gemara is going to spend a crazy amount of effort and time on this subject. And the craziest thing about it is, of anything, whereas, for example, cooking, a fire, making something that's going to change from some form to another form and making it better in the process. So that I get as creative action and enhancing something and changing the action, the item. Here we're taking something from place A and moving it to place B, and somehow that's going to fall under the category of creative activity. It's very strange. And then on top of that, that the Gemara is going to spend this crazy amount of time talking about this is just, and here Tosos is saying, this is not, you know, this is kind of an outlier in defining what creative work is, malacha. So we're going to have to, the challenge here is to figure out what is going on here. There's something deep that's going on here that we need to figure out. So let's just, I'm going to do a screen share here so that we can take a look at a couple of things here. Where's my screen share? Okay. Is this it? I think this is it. Yeah. Right. You see that? You see the screen?
Yep.
Okay. Okay. So I'm going to show you. Let's go to the Torah first. Okay. The backdrop of this portion here. Okay, is the story of the manna, the first time that the Jews are in the desert and they don't have food, and God says, okay, we're going to send them, they need food, and God sends the manna. And so, and what's interesting here is, by the way, is just the context. We don't really have any directive about Shabbos yet. But in the context of the man coming, when the Israelites saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, that is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. Okay? So this is the man. We're in that. And it basically be this idea of there's a daily allotment. It wasn't like you got it for the week. You had to go every day. Which is a whole discussion as to why it was done in that format. Fine. But they didn't listen. But they didn't pay attention to Moses. Some of them left on it, of it until morning, and it became infested with maggots and stank. And Moses was angry at them because they couldn't get their heads around this idea. You cannot store it overnight. You got to take for today, and that's it. Tomorrow's another day. Basically creating this idea of emunah, of belief, and trust that this is going to happen every day. Fine. Comes to the sixth day, they gathered double the amount of food, two omers for each. And when all the chieftains of the community came and told Moses, he said to them, this is what the Lord meant. Tomorrow is a day of rest, a holy Sabbath of the Lord. Bake what you would bake and boil what you would boil. And all that is left, put it aside to be kept until morning. So the exception of the standard ruling will be that when it comes to Friday, we're going to do double. So that Shabbos comes, you can't go out, okay? So they put it aside until morning, and Moses had ordered, and it did not turn foul, and there were no maggots in it. Meaning, so here's normally every day, if you kept it overnight, it would go bad. Comes Friday, and actually you're being told, this is the exception. Tonight, or today, Friday, do double, because Shabbos, you're not going to go out. Store it overnight for Shabbos, okay? And Moses said, eat it today, for today is the Sabbath of the Lord. You will not find it today on the plain. 6 days you shall gather it. On the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will be none. Yet some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather, but they found nothing. Okay? And the Lord said to Moses, how long will you men refuse to obey my commandments and my teachings? Mark that the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, he gives you 2 days of food on the sixth day. Let everyone remain where he is. Let no one leave his place on the seventh day. Okay? So that the people remain inactive on the seventh day. So this
is the worst job ever Moses had. I mean, everyone's like, he's got to corral these idiots.
It's a big challenge.
Ugh.
Right? So very not easy. Okay? So we see this idea of the first time that we see this idea of ish tachtav ayetze ish memkomo. Shavu ish tachtav ayetze ish memkomo biyomashvi. Let everyone remain where he is. Let no one leave his place on the seventh day. Okay? So we see this idea of staying, that when it comes to Shabbos, there's this idea of place. Now, this line is can go either way. Now, what I mean by that either way, it doesn't necessarily mean at this point that you can't carry from one domain to another domain per se, but you see this idea of place being important, that you shouldn't leave your place when it comes to Shabbos, okay? Does this mean that this is an extension of not carrying from one domain to the other? So Tosa seems to bring this down. There is another derivation of transferring from one domain to the other, and that is that when it came to the tabernacle, here they are in the desert. The desert was a public domain, and they had wagons where they kept the beams for the Mishkan, for the tabernacle, and it says that they couldn't transfer from that wagon into the public domain. So wagon's a private domain into the public domain. Now maybe that's where you have this idea of going from, the idea of not the restriction of carrying from one domain to the other is that model. But this first, what I just showed you here is the model of, and I just lost the puzzle. I don't know how that jumped there. Okay, so this idea that this idea of not leaving one domain for the other is at least the first time that we see this idea, the principle of Shabbos having this placement of don't go from your place here. Okay,
so have the Jews gotten the Ten Commandments at this point?
No, so they haven't gotten the Ten Commandments. This is, you know what this is? This is the in terms of the chronology here, they just went through the splitting of the sea. And after the splitting of the sea, you have what we call the Parshat Haman, where basically this idea of the introduction of the man that's going to feed them for the next, at that time was supposed to be a short thing. It wasn't, they were supposed to go, you know, it's like, here we forget like what should have happened. What should have happened is the Jews come out of Egypt, they get to the sea, it splits on the seventh day after leaving. And then from the day that they left Egypt, 49 days, the 50th day, they get the Torah at Sinai. And then after that, they're supposed to go into the land of Israel like 11 days later. But then what happens is things are, well, let's say after Moses comes down, but with the tablets, which is 40 days later from the revelation. But then they sit with the golden calf and things kind of spiral out of control. Then you have the sin of the spies. When that occurs, you know, then the next thing you know, you're in the desert for 40 years. And
is there even a Sabbath at this point?
Well, no, so the introduction of Sabbath is in this context. Now, you could say that, so in this context is the introduction of the Sabbath, because the idea within the context of Man, which is kind of interesting, is that here the instruction of how the Man should play is every day, just take your day's worth that day. Then Moses comes and tells them, guys, there's this thing called Shabbos, which means that you're not going to be able to go out on the Sabbath to get your man. Therefore, on Friday, take two portions. So that whole idea, by the way, guys, when you look at that table on Friday night and you have two challahs.
Yeah. You always have $2.
Right? Yeah. It's coming from here. This is the original derivation, okay? But that, what's interesting is that perhaps, just this is a side, which is something to think about, what would be the significance of the idea of Shabbos being introduced to us through the story of the Mon, okay? That's something to put that on the side, maybe write as a note to think about what is the significance of Mon and the idea that God provides on a daily basis, that should be the derivation of an intro, perhaps, or one of the introductions of us to Shabbos, right? And that the double portion...
It's a hook.
What?
It's a hook. It's the most concrete manifestation of God caring for you by giving you actual food. Like, you build upon that. You build upon your basic needs are now cared for or attended to. You're fed.
Mm.
And that way you can begin to say, okay, what's next? Okay, God gave me this manna pours from heaven and it tastes like whatever I want it to taste like. And it's like it's your basic needs are satisfied now. You know?
Mm.
I also think it's the idea of they went through this crazy supernatural event and that was amazing, but this is a very basic human need that's being, like you were talking about, being provided for. But it's so it's not that just that superhero aspect and then I leave you, but that I'm it's an ongoing relationship and I'm with you all the time.
Okay, so it's like you're this is like on the most basic level, like of humanity and a relationship with God, within that context you have like it's just like about a relationship, and in there God is already now laying down or introducing this idea that Shabbos is going to be different. The seventh day is different, therefore the sixth day is a preparation for that day. But it's interesting within the month. Okay, fine. I'm just leaving it as a side. You know, there's what that's spoken about, but it's an interesting thing to think about.
How can God even, and I don't want to question God, right? But how can he say, how long will you men refuse to obey my commandments and my teachings? He hasn't given them anything at this point.
He did know. He told them. Well, no, because you see, like, there's...
He said it to Moses.
There's no commandment to keep the Shabbos.
Yeah, so he did. He gave them the commandment. He gives them this commandment here. He's basically saying, listen, guys, the first step was, you want the Mon. The Mon's a daily thing. They didn't listen. That's what happened. They didn't listen. They started storing it overnight. And God's like, I told you guys, it's a daily deal. Then he turns around and says, okay, listen, Friday's different. You can store that one because Shabbos, you're not going out. They didn't listen either. Now, again, what's interesting is, but always remember, this is very important. It doesn't mean that everybody, there were people that just didn't listen. Not that, I think that you had people that listened. There were people that didn't listen. And the question is, what's the percentages of those who actually listened that didn't listen? I don't know. It's not clear. Okay. But you see that the idea that God's saying, he's like, listen, I just told them, listen, guys, okay, every day it's a daily deal. Friday is different because Shabbos is not going to be, and therefore prepare on Friday for Shabbos. And they're not listening. Moses, they didn't listen. Okay, fine. Now, just look over here. I just want to show you this, because again, this idea of abide, that every man should be in his place. From here, the sages derive. Now, this is Rashi. From here, the sages derive the support for the permission that a person who has gone beyond the Sabbath limit may move within a space of 4 cubits. So you see, on that one, that's telling us this idea that there's this idea of Tchum Shabbos. Now, what's Tchum Shabbos? Tchum Shabbos means, Tchum means a boundary. Tchum Shabbos means that a person, there's a law that says that you cannot go wherever you are on Friday afternoon at sundown, at sunset, wherever you are, you cannot travel 2,000 cubits outside from that. Now, on the surface, it says what? So where I'm within my house, now I only can travel 2,000, let's call that like a half a mile or whatever the exact distance is outside of where I am at sundown. So the answer is not exactly. What it means is, that from the boundary of your town, so wherever the city limit is, we're going to say that from there, you can't travel more than a certain amount. Now, the question is, what's your city limit? Maybe it's going to be the continuous, you know, settlement, so to speak. So let's say, you, for example, you live in the five towns. So you might live in Lawrence, and then Lawrence is connected to Woodmere and Hewlett. There's like a consistent line of housing. So your city limit's not limited to just Lawrence. It's going to be a much greater area because there's no break in terms of the housing. So that's a greater area that you can travel. But there's this concept. So, for example, let's say I'm up in New Hampshire where things are very, you know, spread out. Yeah, you know what? That actually, where you are, is going to be defined at sundown, and you can't travel past a certain, because there's nothing around you, Tum Shabbos kicks in. But there's this concept of where you are on Friday afternoon at sunset, it's going to be your place for the next 24, 25 hours. That's called Tum Shabbos. So that's what this is referring to here. That's and there's this connection between the idea of carrying from one domain to another and the idea of that Tchum Shabbos, of how far you can travel outside of your place when the sun sets on Friday afternoon. They're kind of connected because they're both working on this idea of place, making a difference, mattering is not a word, that matters. So it's definitive. Let's go, there's a definitive thing that occurs that as the sun sets on Friday afternoon, your place, where you are, becomes very important in terms of your next 25 hours of existence. Like, that's where things are. It's all about where you are at that time, and your place of where you are is everything, to the point of where you can't go outside of it. You can't move things from one place to the other per se, but there's something about your place that becomes, and the idea of makom, place, becomes very, very important, okay? And then, so to the next, what Rashi says here, al yetze ish bemkom, a person can't go out. Again, from this point of the Torah telling us that the time when the manna came, and God said, and Moses told us, that the idea is that when it comes to Shabbos, you're not going to go out the next day to collect your manna because your place where you are is important to the point where you cannot go out of it. So here Rashi says, these are the 2,000 cubits of the Sabbath limit, but this is not expressly mentioned here because the command relating to the Sabbath limits is only an institution of the Sofrim. The text itself is really spoken about those who gathered the manna. It does not constitute a prohibition regarding the Sabbath for all men and at all periods, but was intended to forbid anyone to go out into the field to gather the manna. So what Rashi's telling us is that it's a later, it isn't necessarily definitive at that point about the place, or there is something about place, but Rashi's saying perhaps it's just limited to that time of the manna, but there seems to be they're deriving from this place, I shouldn't use that word. They're deriving from this idea of important of place and about going outside of your domain. Okay?
Jonathan, it's the intent.
Say it again?
The intent you're talking about.
Yes, but you see, again, Rashi's just, Rashi's one, he's pulling on a mechilta. It's one idea that not necessarily to say, when you look at others that are going to explain it, they'll look at this and say, no, this is the source. The idea that you can't go out of your domain and go 2,000 cubits outside of your place at sunset is coming from here. This is the derivation. Okay.
How did he go from 4 to 2,000?
So it's 2,000 plus 4. That's what that was.
What's a cubit roughly equal?
So that's where I it's like, I want to say it could be as much as, let's say, 3 feet each. I don't know. That's why I don't want to, it's going to end up being like a half, let's use a half a mile to a mile. Okay. And we can, and by the way, we'll go to that. We'll, at a certain point, we'll come to see how exactly contemporary decisors will define that. Okay, that's important. Okay, Okay, and there's more to it. I'm right now we're really at the beginning points. We're going step by step, and don't sweat the detail yet. Meaning we'll get to we'll bring it to from here. We're thousands of years away from getting to the modern time. We're really starting at really stage one. Okay, so let's just look. I'm now going to jump to the Gemara. Let's look at the Gemara a little bit today. And then this is just I'm whetting your appetites, okay? So we're just starting, so don't and one of the things that we have to always when we come to learning Gemara, you have to have patience. We have to let the Gemara kind of play out a little bit, there's a need to be patient to let it kind of develop, and. And then, because the development's more important sometimes than the actual conclusion, even though we're going to get to the conclusion, we're going to work on that. They're really two sides that we need to appreciate and let each one kind of do its thing. So we need to let the Gemara and the Mishnah kind of play itself out. And then, because in doing so, if you let that really play, you're going to get there's subtleties that are there that are important to pick up on, because later on we'll need those subtleties to be able to understand how the decisors are using those subtleties in order to get to the conclusions that they're going to draw. And those also the subtleties, and you know, that is very important, because as you have things change, right? We have a society that's modern, that's changing all the time. Those subtleties will play very, very much in terms of how they'll figure out the conclusions of the answers of how we apply these things to modern day scenarios. Okay, so now let's look at this Gemara. Okay, we're just starting here. So the Gemara says like this, and again, this is the Gemara. We're starting Talmud Shabbos. Okay, and this is again. The crazy thing is that, and everybody asks the question. If we're going to be talking about the 39 creative acts that are prohibited on Shabbos, and these are all about creative acts, why does the Gemara Shabbos start from here? Now, what does it say? The Mishnah. The acts of carrying out from a public domain into a private domain, or vice versa, which are prohibited on Shabbat, are primarily two basic actions that comprise four cases from the perspective of a person inside a private domain, and two basic actions that comprise four cases from the perspective of a person outside in a public domain. So in English, basically, you have a guy inside a house and you have a guy outside. Now, you're going to have, what we're saying is multiples of 2 plus 2 for the guy on the inside, and so too the guy from the outside. Let's see how so. The mission elaborates. How did these eight cases take place? In order to answer that question, the mission cites cases involving a poor person and a homeowner. The poor person stands outside in the public domain, and the homeowner stands inside in the private domain. The poor person lifted an object in the public domain, extended his hand into the private domain, and placed the object into the hand of the homeowner. In that case, the poor person performed the prohibited labor of carrying from the public domain into the private domain in its entirety. Okay, so let me introduce a concept. In order to be to violate the prohibition, you need to do what we call an akira, which means to lift it up, and also do a hanacha, which means to put it down. If I don't do both actions of lifting and placing, then I have not prohibited I haven't violated the prohibition. I require from A to the C, okay? And also moving it from domain A to domain B, right? So now it means that he lifted it up in the public domain, and he brought it over into the private domain and placed it down into the private domain, okay? Now, or The second case would be the poor person reached his hand into the private domain, took an item from the hand of the homeowner, so he lifts it up and carried it out into the public domain. In that case, the poor person performed the prohibited labor of carrying out from the private domain into the public domain in its entirety. In both of these cases, because the poor person performed the prohibited labor in its entirety, he is liable and the homeowner is exempt. Okay? So, poor guy does the beginning from the public into the private, or takes it from the private into the public. Okay? So, two actions where he is the one who did that, who violated. What do you think the curveball will be? Is that, let's say they don't, let's say the guy only does one side of it and the other guy does the other side. So then changes the whole thing. Okay? So let's see. The Mishnah cites two additional cases. In these, the prohibited labor is performed by the homeowner who is in the private domain. So basically now, this is the inverse of the first case. The first case was the poor guy did everything, both in and out. Now we're going to have the opposite. The homeowner is going to do the in and the out. The homeowner lifted an item in the private domain, extended his hand into the public domain, and placed the object into the hand of the poor person. In that case, the homeowner performed the labor of carrying out from the private domain into the public domain in its entirety, or the homeowner reached his hand into the public domain, took an object from the hand of the poor person, and carried it into the private domain. In that case, the homeowner performed the labor of carrying from the public domain into the private domain in its entirety. In both of these cases, because the homeowner performed the prohibited labor in its entirety, he's liable and the poor person is exempt. Okay? All right. I just have one question right now. Okay? Is there something wrong? Can you tell me what's wrong with, or is there potentially something wrong with what we just described?
Why is it a poor person and a homeowner?
Ah, so that's a very important question that we have to leave. That's a very important detail that we're going to leave hanging. Okay, because there's something very deep there. Nothing's coincidental. There's such depth to like what the this is. We're in the Mishnah. By the way, just as a side. Just to remember context, the Mishnah was put together, was edited by Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. The Mishnah is coming as the first real effort to write, to formally write down the oral tradition. And it's from that, it's a very cryptic study that is followed by the Talmud, which the Talmud's whole raison d'etre is to really expand and to open up the cryptic Mishnah. So right now we're just in the Mishnah here. But what's if I just describe to you that if a guy lifts it up and puts it down, that's the only way that he's going to be over, that he's going to violate the prohibition. What's strange here? Do you notice something strange?
Couldn't it be combined into one? Do you need to?
Well, there's something, right. So the question is why they're playing out each one. Okay. But what's, so I'll tell you like,
why is it okay to lift it but not place it? Like, why is lifting? Why is the first half of that thing not the work?
Well, no. So we're saying. Well, again. So one thing that's going on here is we have to. There's a full. Like, you have to do this whole big thing in order to violate. You have to do like a multiple things, and if it's not done, if one thing is missing from the piece, you're not actually violating. So it's like you have to lift it up. You have to move it from the one domain to the other, and then place it down in that other domain. If you don't do it in its entirety, you have not violated the prohibition. Okay, but
it didn't need to be a recipient for the violation to occur.
So
it's like, aren't these guys both complicit? They didn't need to be two participants. You could have said, look, the poor person just picks it up outside and places it on a table inside.
Right. Yeah. So this is like a big deal, right? So you hit it on the button, you hit it there. What's going on here? You said that the poor guy picks it up from the public domain and he puts it into the hand of the homeowner. In that case, it's only the poor guy who's violated. The fact that the homeowner is got his hands out and he puts it into the guy's hands, we look at it as that the poor guy did all of the acts. He's violated the thing, and the guy who's taking it into his hand has done nothing wrong. And actually, the poor guy putting it into the guy's, into the homeowner's hand is completing the violation. That's lifting and putting it down. The fact that he put it into the homeowner's hands is, we're saying now, is actually part of, meaning that placement into his hands is the, is it, all of the onus, all of the violation, all of the responsibility is squarely on the poor guy's side.
Why isn't the homeowner complicit because he put a hand out to receive it?
Right. So that's a question. Why would that be considered as if the poor guy's put it down into the private domain, which is what we're saying now. Okay. So that's a subtlety that's going on that you wouldn't necessarily like. What's going on here? Why is that's something we have to ask? And I'm sorry, answer. We have to figure that out. Okay. And it goes, and obviously the flip side is true as well. Okay, meaning that if it's the homeowner who takes it in from the picks it up from his house in the private domain and then takes it out and places it into the hands of the poor guy, he's violated the thing because he's done both the lifting and the placing. And the fact that the guy is receiving, we're saying again that receiver didn't do anything wrong. Okay, so we have to understand why. Okay, fine. Now, there are four additional cases. This is still the Mishnah, okay? There are four additional cases where neither the homeowner nor the poor person performed the labor in its entirety, and therefore neither is liable. The poor person extended his hand into the private domain, and either the homeowner took an object from his hand and placed it into the private domain, or the homeowner placed an object into the hand of the poor person, and the poor person carried the object out into the public domain. In those cases, and the two that follow, the act of transferring the object from one domain to another was performed jointly by two people, the poor person and the homeowner, because each performed only part of the prohibited act, both of them are exempt. Right? So you see there's a change here, because it's not like one did both, but rather one did the lifting and the other one took it from there and then put it down. So it's the lifting and the putting down has to be done by the same guy in order to violate. But if you have it shared, that's a different story. So too, in a case where the homeowner extended his hand into the public domain, and either the poor person took an object from the homeowner's hand and placed it in the public domain, or the poor person placed an object into the homeowner's hand and the homeowner carried the object into the private domain, because each performed only part of the prohibited act, both of them are exempt. So going back to the original cases, what we're saying now go back and think about the original case. The original cases were saying, first case, the poor guy takes something, he lifts it up in the public domain, he puts it into the public private domain, and he places it into the hand of the homeowner. That's him doing everything. As opposed to where if the guy lifts it up from the public, and then he brings it into the private domain, but now the homeowner takes it out of his hand, that would be different.
Does this have like the origins of like, you know, giving in tzedakah? Is this like where it's leading?
So it's no, although, but when Eric asked that question about what's the significance of the poor and the homeowner guy. All right, I'll let you in on, like, I was going to wait to kind of show you this idea, but again, going back to the question that we asked at the beginning, this act of moving from one domain to the other, why would it constitute any type of creative activity or any type of something that's doing something? What are you doing when you move something from place A to place B? How does that doing anything? The object is the same thing, whether it was in the public domain or the private domain. There's no change. So what change is being affected
when you move? First of all, I think it depends what you're moving. If you're moving food, you could be being able, you're giving somebody something that they can now use. It depends on what you're moving. Whether there's any creative thing going on there, no?
Maybe. That sounds interesting. I like it. Tell me more.
you're changing the status of the thing.
Status?
Who's in possession of it?
Okay, but so.
I mean, it would be the same as changing money, right? Like, oh, the money is the same thing. But if instead of it being an object, it was money that was passing hands here, you've changed the lay of the land.
So you want to say are you saying it's a that you're changing some kind of ownership and that's what's happening?
Possibly, yeah.
Okay. Anything else?
How about like when someone's giving something, that means that somebody's going to be giving up something, and the other person's receiving something. But how it's being done? If you're both doing it together, you're almost equal. You're equalizing it.
So there are two. So on that point, just to like, so I'm gonna say like this, that on on the point of one person doing something as opposed to two people jointly doing something, when it comes to the laws of Shabbos, and maybe even like other things, but like actually by other things as well, but we use it a lot on Shabbos. Now here's a very interesting, just as a side, but important idea. Is that when it comes to Shabbos, and this is the idea of the subtlety, that when you see this idea of two people doing something is not going to be a violation of at least the biblical law, as opposed to one person doing the whole thing, that let's say I'm in a case or scenario where I need to get something done on Shabbos, that it would be technically a violation, but let's say someone's life is on the line. Right? You have to save someone's life. So we say that the laws of Shabbos are suspended when it comes to saving a life. But there is this idea that if I can somehow maintain the sanctity of Shabbos as best as I can, and at the same time save the life, I might try to do that. Right? I might try to do both at the same time. If I can do two things, accomplish two things at the same time, I'd rather do that. Meaning, I want to save the life. But I have Shabbos that's going to be violated. But if I can violate Shabbos on a lesser level, then I'll do that. So then if I have a concept of two people doing something, that's not really a biblical violation. Because when do you say that you really have violated a prohibition? It's when I do the act completely by my own. But if two people do something, it's not, which is derived from this Mishnah, the subtlety of the Mishnah is telling us that Shtayim Sha'asu, that if two people do something, it's biblically, again, rabbinically, it will still be an issue. But if I have a scenario where I need to do something to violate Shabbos, that I'm going to do it like this way, because in this way I'm lessening the prohibition, so to speak, I'm going to do it. So now that I understand that there's this concept of two people doing something, so for example, you have to open up a syringe hey, come over here, let's do it together. Because I'm going to violate.
Or dial 911. You open the phone.
Yeah, or
dial 9. I'll dial 1. You dial 1.
Correct. Right. So perhaps right. That's so. You see, from here, this is just one time where, but it's telling us that. Okay. But going back to this thing, you have something transferring. So Steve said something about the idea of transfer. Someone said something about changing status. Right. So and then Eric asked.
Between private and public. Public and private. Somehow the object changes status in some way.
So now, Eric...
Some sanctity to the...
Well, hold on, let's see, like this. Eric asked something, what's the significance of the fact that one guy is poor and one guy is wealthy? Or is quote-unquote not poor, right? And so the analogy that you give is that it's true that the object has not changed whatsoever from moving from A to B, right? But, so Steve said something about the idea of ownership. But perhaps the value of something changes. Because when I take something, let's just use the example of the guy who's the homeowner giving it to the poor guy. When I have this slice of bread, to me it's worth whatever, it's worth something. But the guy who's starving outside and I give him a piece of bread, that bread is worth a lot more to that guy. So the bread's the same, but the value of the bread has changed. When you transfer from poor guy from wealthy guy to poor guy, homeowner to poor guy, right? So now we start to see that place where something is. And now the Mishnah is going to highlight it by saying it's not just the place, but also who the person is, maybe. Okay. But clearly, and so like the idea that I heard years ago is like, a gallon of gas that's sitting in Saudi Arabia is not the same as a gallon of gas that's sitting in New Jersey in Teaneck, right? The value, it costs more to have that to get that gallon of gas here in Teaneck than it did in Saudi. Okay, so we see that the place of where something is creates or actually dictates what the value of something is, right? So by moving from A to B, from private to public, public to private, now the Mishnah is throwing in a curveball, which is that also who the people are is playing a factor. But it, so in a way, if we look at this and we analyze this Mishnah, do you say that it is the fact that it's using the poor and the wealthy people in the scenario, does it take away from the where the thing is? Or is it just highlighting the fact that it's the place of where something is actually dictates what its value is? And by moving something from A to B does change value, and that's the issue, right?
That's the creative piece of it.
Correct. Correct. So it's what's funny about it is that Tosfos will say this is a malacha gerua. This act is a gerua means like it's lacking, right? It's a creative act that's lacking. So do you say that as like, oh, it's negative, or does it mean that it means like, no, it's that the way we normally would think of creative activity is like I'm changing the physical attributes of something, right? I'm taking a piece of dough and I make it into bread. I've changed it. I've made it better. I took a raw piece of chicken and I cooked it and now it's edible. So there is a change within the actual physical properties of something, right? Whereas here we're saying there's no physical change, but that's even bigger, is that maybe this is even more beautiful, is that I'm changing what this is by changing its place or its ownership, as Steve talked about, that these are multiple things that are going at the same time. I'm changing status with ownership and placement, and all those things are creative in a sense.
I think it's highlighting, obviously, by using the rich and the poor, but this works for two homeowners as well.
Right.
If I carry from one place to another place.
That is correct. That is correct.
Wait, why does it work? Because if there are two homeowners and you take something from one homeowner's domain to the other homeowner's domain and there's no change because the homeowner are on equal footing, you haven't added anything. The slice of bread is still the same value to the one homeowner to the other homeowner. There's no value added there.
Right. So so the question is, does it? So what's interesting is now let's take a stop for a second here.
Hold on. Jonathan, you used the fact that rows of houses, if you go from one house next door to another house, you've never gone to the public domain. You've gone from one private domain to another private domain.
So now that's the question. If let's say I do right now, clear cut. Let's just make sure we got this straight. The Mishnah is saying very clearly, private to public, public to private. What if I go from private to private? Right? So that might not be a problem. That actually might not be a problem.
Is that with the Eruv? Is that how you get around it?
So Eruv, right. So Eruv will say that all of this is one domain. Yes.
The courtyards are connected.
That's all one. Exactly. It's all one. Domain. It's creating a unified domain. Does not address, by the way, you should know, Eruv does not address the issue of traveling 2,000 cubits outside of your place. What does, again, is this idea, we have to, that's Tchum Shabbos, that idea of where you are when Shabbos begins, by the way, Shino, is something that is so not well known in all circles. It's not like I feel like even in, you know, those who are you know, more familiar with the laws, even this, the Tchum Shabbos thing, it's so not, people are not sensitive to, because we live in these places that are so, like, large cities that the sensitivity to it is lacking, so that when you were to go, like, i.e., into, like, a place like a New Hampshire, I'm using that because I had that scenario where I went for Shabbos, New Hampshire, and I was like, wait a second, this might be an issue. I might not be able to walk to shul because I'm really far and there's a big gap of no homes anywhere near this vicinity. I might have an issue here, okay? So, and in that case, there are ways to work it where you can create it, what they call an Eruv Tchumim, like you can create an extension of your place. No, that's a real thing. But it's, again,
that by just having a meal, like if you create a meal.
Good, right. So you have to place it somewhere further down, and that becomes your, we'll call it your virtual place of at sunset. And so therefore now from that place you'll extend. So if that works, it might not even work if you're in like some really far out place. Guess what? You're not going anywhere on Shabbos. You're like, that's where you are. You're like, this is your little, you can know.
Jonathan, on a practical note,
yeah.
Just because I honestly never really thought about the rules of it. So when I'm invited to someone's house in Teaneck for Shabbos, right? I don't really bring anything. I'm not supposed to bring something from me to give a bottle of wine or something or food. But can a neighbor walk over with food and for that meal?
So the answer is yes. But also going back to your scenario, that idea of bringing something from, let's say, this is the question: is Fair Lawn, right, to Teaneck, is that considered to be one settled area or not? It's very possible, like if you look at it from Fair Lawn all the way, is there a continuous, settlement of homes from there to there, and without any major break, that would not be an issue, okay? That's something that we'd have to look at. And there's a lot of, that's a whole nother subject. Right. The answer to that is that it might not be an issue. Okay, there's like we say, like there's one to rely on to say that when you look at it and you take out a map and you start looking at the mapping it out, and the way it's, again, we would have to take the rules of how that applies. It could be that that's a scenario where it's not an issue. Okay, so it's interesting. It's like the same thing like for David. Like David's living where he is, right? It could be that from where David is all the way to Far Rockaway, okay, let's say that happened, that you might have a continuous, or maybe not. It might be that it's not. And the breaks that might occur, actually, the way this is done. I'll give you an example. This is a very interesting question. But this is, again, Tchum Shabbos. Can you cross the George Washington Bridge on Shabbos? I'm in Englewood, and I work at Columbia, okay? So can I walk from Englewood, now, realistically, or Fort Lee, it's even better. I'm in Fort Lee, and I'm a doctor. I work at Columbia Presbyterian, which is across the bridge. Can I walk that bridge, or is that a violation of this issue of Tchum Shabbos? Okay. So, the question. So, if you look at it on the surface, it looks like no way. There's no how I don't know how you could pull that one off, right? Are you going to put something on the middle of the bridge and extend your thing? Maybe that's an option. But
hold on a second. I think this also goes back to the question that you brought up before, private domain to private domain.
No. This is something different. No, this is different. This is different. We're talking two different things here. The Mishnah is talking about taking from one domain to the other. That's called hotza'a. That's about taking out from one domain
to place to place.
Correct.
Place to
place. Yeah, there's this idea that where you are when the sun sets on Friday is going to be your place, and you only have a certain amount that you can walk. But again, that's within your city limits. So if your city is bigger, okay, so how would you work? Is there any workaround for the George Washington Bridge? So it's possible. So there's here, I'll introduce them just so you see like how this kind of works, okay? And another example would be Far Rockaway to Long Beach or Atlantic Beach, okay? You have this bridge. Can you walk that bridge? Okay, there's another, it's a little bit easier because that one's a shorter bridge. And so the answer to this is that there is this idea of squaring. Okay, listen to this. You take the last house of your settlement, and then you look at the next house, and you can actually create a square so that there's this idea, there's this leeway. This is, again, this is kind of of what we'd have to go through the whole, like, we call it the sugya, to show you how this works. But there's this idea of taking an area, and it's not just like, boom, that house is the last house on this map, but actually from where that last outlying area of your settlement is, you would then square, and by squaring from there to like the next house, all of a sudden you'll see that your city line is extended. Okay, and in that way, by extending, like let's say you have one house that juts out, and all of a sudden now you're going to square it off. You're going to notice that your city line is going to be much longer than what you thought it was. And the next thing you know, your city line to the next city line is not that 2,000 cubits. Okay? So that if you play that game where there's a jutting out, I don't know if it works for the GW. I'm not sure. I really don't know. When it comes to Atlantic Bridge, it does work. They looked at it and they showed that the last house that juts out on Far Rockaway, it actually closes the gap, and that you don't really have that gap. So there's what to rely on to be able to cross that bridge on Shabbos. Now, there are others that might say to you, I don't buy that. I don't see it that way. I don't map it that way. But that's something to, like, you ask a guy like Josh Brody, call him up and say, hey, are you allowed to cross over the Atlantic Beach Bridge on Shabbos? See what he has to say. It'll be interesting, okay? I don't know. I'm curious to know, like, how people – I remember when I was growing up there that was, like, something that that's something that people like to do on Shabbos. They like to walk from Far Rockaway over to the boardwalk in Atlantic Beach. Can you do that with this in mind? Okay. But back to our thing. So what we're saying now, we wanted to understand, is there significance about the poor person to the homeowner? And what we basically are learning at this point is that the idea of moving something from point A to point B is that the creative part of it is that you're actually changing the value of something when you move it from point A to point B. And that's the creative activity that's involved in what we call hotza'ah, which means to take out. Even though there's this idea of taking out and taking in, we use that as the word yitzia, to go out, even though it means also the same thing on the inverse of taking something from the outside in. Okay? But with the one thing, the big takeaway from today so far, the chiddush, so to speak, the new idea is that the fact, the subtlety of the case that the Mishnah brought to us of a poor person and the house owner, the homeowner, is that when you move something from one place to another place, the reason why it's a problem or an issue or creative act for the purposes of Shabbos is by moving something from one place to the other, it's a change. It actually, you change the value of something, and that itself is constitutes a creative act, malacha.
So okay. What about the cases then of private to private and from public to public within the domain, and the case of whether there's a two homeowners or two poor people?
Let's use this. The case of the private to private, we're gonna have to figure out if that's a problem. In the public domain, that's another thing, okay, which is not introduced here, but I'll tell you so you know that it exists, is that there is an issue of moving something a certain amount of area within the public domain. Meaning, I'm in the public domain and I have something in my hand. I cannot carry it more than 4 amot. Okay? So there are 4 amot. I can't move. If I'm standing and I have something in my hand, I can't go more than 4 amot in the public domain. That's also an issue. We're going to have to figure out, we'll see why, okay? So we're going to start adding in more and more of these different things as we go along. We're just starting out, and we have to see exactly how each one of these things, you know, we're building a tapestry, so to speak. Okay, so we're just really, like, you know, and what's interesting here is that as the Talmud is introducing to us the whole gamut of Shabbos and how we're supposed to approach Shabbos, what's interesting is that it spends a lot of time on this subject matter, more than the other 38 melachot, which is, again, what the takeaway will be is that there's something very deep to the idea of place when it comes to Shabbos. I mean, Shabbos is a sanctity of time, but place and where we are at the time of when Shabbos comes, when Friday night enters, when we have that sunset and we enter this time space, that where we physically are becomes very important. Okay? That's clearly from the fact that that we spend so much time discussing this. So, yeah. Okay, so I don't know. Let's look a little bit more at the Gemara. You'll see something, just, it's important. Like, you know, I can jump over this, but I just want to, like, go a little bit in the Gemara just to show you The first thing the Gemara needs to do is, it's kind of interesting that a lot of times when a tractate begins, it will ask, why did the Mishnah, you know, format itself the way it did, and compares it to other places within the Talmud, or in Shas, we call it, the, you know, Mishnah and the Talmud, the greater oral tradition. So we learned in our Mishnah, the acts of carrying on Shabbat are two that comprise four. Similarly, we learned in the Mishnah there, in Tractate Shavuot, oaths on the statement, which when violated render one liable to bring a sin offering, are two that comprise four. The first two cases which are mentioned explicitly in the Torah are one who swore that he perform a specific action in the future, and one who swore to refrain from performing said action, right? So you can make you can swear that what I'm going to do such and such, or I'm not going to do such and such. So based on an amplification in the language of the Torah, two more cases are added, one who swore that he performed a specific action in the past, and one who swore that he did not perform an action, said action. Okay? So first things first, what it's talking about here is future. The Torah says don't swear in the future to either do something or to not do something. And then it says there's an additional thing about I swore that I didn't do such and such, or I swear that I did something. Okay, those are the rabbinic things, or additional things. Similarly, with regard to the awareness of ritual impurity, there are two cases that comprise four. It's prohibited for one who is ritually impure to enter the temple or to consume a consecrated item. However, one who unwittingly violates this serious prohibition is obligated to bring a sacrifice for his transgression only if he was clearly aware of his ritually impure status both before committing the transgression and thereafter. The two cases of unwitting transgression in this area are one who was aware and then forgot that he is ritually impure and then either ate consecrated meat or entered the temple and subsequently recalled that he was ritually impure. Two additional cases are one who was aware of his ritually impure status, but was unaware that the food that he was about to eat was consecrated and ate it, or he was unaware that he was about to enter the temple and entered it. Okay. So now what the Talmud is doing is he's rolling out multiple cases of where they use this idea of two that was four, two that was four, two that was four. So first one case was the idea of swearing. One is another case of spiritual impurity. Then there's another case of with leprosy, signs of affliction by leprosy of two that comprise four. The Torah mentions two types of signs of affliction with regard to leprosy, Baharat and Sa'it. Two additional secondary signs of afflicted were added. They are not as white as those delineated by the Torah. Consequently, these are derivatives of both Baharat and Sa'it. Okay. And then our case, the Mishnah in Shavuot also mentions the acts of carrying out on Shabbat that are two basic actions that comprise four. So now, finally, the Gemara asks the question. The Gemara asks, what is different here that our Mishnah teaches two that comprise four inside and two that comprise four outside? What is different there in so in Shavuot, it only says two that are four. That's it. Here it says two that are four in, two that are four out. So it's, our cases are much more than the case of in Shavuot. It's like abridged. Here it's opened. So the question is, why is it different? Why is it different here? Two that comprise four inside, two that comprise four outside, whereas in Shavuot it just says two comprise four and nothing more. So the Gemara answers here in Tractate Shabbat, which contains the primary discussion of the halachot of Shabbat, the Mishnah teaches the primary categories of the labor that are prohibited on Shabbat, including carrying out from the private to the public domain, and it teaches the subcategories of labor that are prohibited on Shabbat, including carrying from the public into the private. But there, in the Tractate Shavuot, which does not contain the primary discussion of the laws of Shabbat, halachot of Shabbat, the Mishnah teaches the primary categories of labor prohibited on Shabbat, but does not teach the subcategories of labor. Okay. So, let's see. Okay, so let me just see. Okay, so I think I'm going to stop here. So the goal for next time is, so we'll continue a little more in the Talmud. Just seeing a little bit more. Yeah, we'll continue a little bit more into like how the Gemara is going to just, it's just really like looking at the semantics of the, but it's important, just it's parsing to get us to like understanding more of the subtleties here. And then from there, well, from that point, I'm going to jump around a little bit and kind of continue, God willing, a little bit more into the Rishonim, like how do the early commentaries understand what just happened here, like pushing into like seeing like a little bit more of the subtlety that's going on here, and then figure out a little bit more into how this plays out, bringing it down to like how it applies to us. Okay, but again, there's still more to go here in terms of delving into the Gemara. We're going to do a little more of the Talmud. Then at the same time, when we learn Talmud, a lot of times people, like different ways of looking at it, you, like go and stop at each line and see how the rabbis, how their commentaries parse it. So you could do it like that, or do more of the Talmud, then come back and go back to the, see, look, let's go back and look at the subtleties and understand, because it says it this way as opposed to that way, what is it that we derive from it? What is the takeaway? And then at the same time, I'm going to try to take this and bring it down to like, bring it to like modern day cases. How does this apply today in terms of how we apply it to how we observe Shabbos, right? So we'll try to do that. But again, I have to figure out exactly at what point we make that jump to the more of the modern. So we'll, next time we'll continue on this. We call Chazer. We're going to go back, review it, make sure we have, you know, things a little bit clearer in our, you know, we have clarity. And then from there, continue on in terms of the way the Talmud, the way it develops things. And then we saw in the past, when we go through Talmud, it always goes off onto the side, you know, we get off a little bit onto, you know, these other, you know, discussions. And then, but again, the idea here really is like what we call Aliba de Hilchasa. My goal here is to be able to show how things developed and then bring it to like modern day practice so that we can understand how these things would apply. Okay?
Jonathan, can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
Not specific to this, but about oral tradition in general.
Mm-hmm.
So how does it, is there always a jumping off point, or how is it the jumping off point in the Torah to the oral tradition dictated? Meaning that section that you started with where you talked about, where you read the part and it talked about the space, which basically, so when the oral tradition was given, is there an indication of where that oral tradition connects to the Torah? Like here we're connecting it to, so it, is this something, the way that you did it now, is this how it's always done, or, like,
So the answer, so the answer is like this. Everything in oral tradition is tied back to the Torah, the five books, always. So any type of principle that you see that there's a discussion in oral, it's always derived from biblical text. Always. There's not an exception to that. Within that, you'll have, you know, expansive ideas always built off of the biblical text. So, but, and then, it, you know, we'll derive certain ideas that are extrapolated, but it always has its kernel, the core is always going to be biblical.
But I mean, is it always, is this, that core that we started with, the core that all of the rabbis that went, and the sages that went forward, is that always the part that got them thinking about, you know, was a discussion about in with regard to the manna and space, the launch point for the oral tradition to begin talking about it in a more expansive way.
Okay, so but it's not, so what I showed you today is not the only source and what's interesting is what you'll find is that a lot of discussions where there'll be where you'll have a a difference of opinion of approach is that they'll have a discussion and you'll see that they're arguing about how we understand the reading of the biblical. Like it's a very common thing that's the point of departure, that they'll say, you know, no, I don't see it that way because you read it this way as opposed to that way. It's over and over again where you have the core of the discussion will be based on how I read and how I understand the biblical reading. That's always the beginning. Now here, I showed you one sentence, one derivation of the monoparsha, but there's another place that we have to look at also. So maybe next week I'll bring you that also to expand it, so that now you're seeing like there's more going on here, that on this subject matter in terms of like the derivation of this subject matter, right?
Yeah, I always knew both were given. I heard that the Torah is like a abbreviated version with a lot of subtleties not there. Obviously, the oral tradition is more expansive, but I never understood, like, there's no notation that says like,
Right. So no. So the oral tradition is it's all connected. So it's all. It's not like they came along. First of all, the oral tradition runs parallel to the right. To the biblical, right? So it's a necessary. You need they're tied in together. One is based on the other. So you can't understand. For example, tefillin. Just as a side. You don't know, how do you know that they're black and that they're square and they're all these things? That's all oral.
Right.
There are things in the biblical directive that you can see that are jumping points to getting to that, and they're tied in, meaning it was clearly given at the time when all this stuff was happening at the biblical, it was, the oral was there. It had to be, otherwise there's no understanding, right? What's important, a very important idea, okay, as you read through the Torah, one has to understand that what was given, let's say we just read about the revelation at Sinai and the Ten Commandments. Next week we're going to read about a lot of commandments. But the actual Torah scroll that we have, when we take out a Torah, was actually developed during the 40 years that the Jews were in the desert. So that the last book for sure, the Devarim, is written the last 36 days of Moses' life. So the completion of that Torah scroll was over that period of time. It's not like Moshe came down from our Sinai and he had like his, Torah. That's not what happened. So, and unfortunately, people don't understand that. And then they make mistakes. This was clearly like given to Moses over the period of 40 years and then written down. Then the big question is, who wrote the last X amount of lines when Moses dies, right? That's a whole question. Did Moses write it based on prophecy, or did Joshua write it? Or like, there's a whole discussion in the Talmud as to how that played. But the point is that this is something that was given to us over a period of time to Moses prophetically, not just at Mount Sinai, although there are ideas, understandings that the core of it was all given at Sinai. And then, so there's a lot of discussion as to how exactly there are two opinions as to how exactly, or Bekevin and I forget who the other Tama is, but that it was given out. I mean, that was how exactly it was transmitted. But the idea that oral tradition was given at the same time. So these are two things that are going hand in hand. It's not like just what it's written in the Bible, but you'll find all these rabbinic things. Or all the oral tradition is clearly based on biblical texts. I'll give you even more, that when you go to Kabbalistic ideas, that's also derived from very, very sharp analytical understanding of the biblical texts. So if you take out a Zohar, the Zohar a lot of times is beautiful, is like reading and explaining how to understand the biblical text on the deepest level. The deepest level. It's really unbelievable. That's why they say you can't just like take out a Zohar and just like, have no understanding of biblical text. It's like insane because it's all derived from that same biblical text. So the biblical text is the place that it all starts. And then all this development work is understanding that, understanding the biblical text on the deepest level.
Got it. Okay. A piece of it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Jonathan. Good
talk. Thank you.
All right. Have a good week, everybody.
Have a great week. All the best.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.